auditions begin in January 2019, which can be made in person, mail, online, or by phone. Call 262-889-8457 for more.
This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show, we're going to talk about how MasterCard and Microsoft want to take control of your identity, something called privileged identity management, which also speaks to password management things in general. A fascinating new documentary that's been put out called The Creepy Line. And then Sundar Pichai of Google, the CEO of Google, literally went in front of Congress and lied to them. Well, let's get started. So first, let's talk about MasterCard and Microsoft wanting to take control of your identity. This is a fascinating article published on December 6th, and I will publish a link to it so you can see it for yourself. And it's basically an analysis of a joint press release issued by Microsoft and MasterCard. And you may recall on a prior show, I talked about how Visa and Google had gotten together and decided to share information. And as a result, well, of course, this was supposed to be fully anonymized. Well, we'll see about that. But supposedly, this sharing of information between Visa and Google was supposed to be helpful for advertisers to be able to discern whether or not their advertising actually leads to a purchase. And so it was done under the guise of that, when in reality, I think there's more nefarious purposes going on there. Well, so not to be left out of the joy and festivities of having a complete ubiquitous profile on you, Microsoft decided that they wanted to go into this joint agreement with MasterCard. And what they're advocating is one identity. And this is right along the same time frame here where Microsoft is also advocating passwordless sign-in to everything. And there are massive problems with going passwordless. One of the bigger problems with going passwordless is this assumption that everything that is happening on the endpoint where you've authorized this passwordless state, meaning that the device, whether it be your Windows computer or whatever, but let's say you've authorized your Windows computer to effectively act on your behalf and authenticate on your behalf to all kinds of resources. Now, the only unlock state for the computer, or the only login component that's even required, is your face. So this requires the camera, of course, being on, and this biometric authentication, which, let me remind you, you have no Fifth Amendment protection over whatsoever. This has been well established in Supreme Court law that the only thing that you actually have Fifth Amendment protection over are the passwords stored in your brain. So your face, they can compel you, whether you're talking about Customs, Border Patrol, or whoever, that is law enforcement of any shape, size, or flavor, can literally just compel you to show your face to the computer and voila, unlock your computer, and then they are into everything that's in there. Now, beyond that, this whole passwordless state is not really passwordless, is it? No, it's really a matter of where Microsoft has this system that if you enroll into it, your computer does all these authentications on your behalf. So if the endpoint, your computer, gets compromised, then whatever the malicious processes are that are running on that endpoint get to just seamlessly authenticate as if they are you to everything that you've hooked up with this passwordless authentication mechanism. So there's some major problems with that. Well, let's go back to this whole one identity concept. So Microsoft and MasterCard are claiming that by having this integrated one identity, what they're advocating for is the improvement and speed of applications for establishing a new bank account, a loan payment service account, having a more personalized and efficient shopping experience online. Yeah, more personalized means what? Means, yeah, they've got a profile on you. And it's comprehensive. They want to simplify your interactions with government agencies and services, such as filing taxes, applying for passports, or supporting payments, such as your Social Security payment. And then digital services, such as streamline and providing use of email, social media, movie music streaming services, and rideshare platforms. Okay, so that's a very, very extensive covering of what this one identity is really supposed to be being used for. They're effectively saying that this one identity is going to be used for anything and everything, your interaction with the government, any sort of digital services that you're buying, any sort of online shopping, and most likely shopping in brick and mortar stores too, because there's this huge push to have everyone have a trackable smartphone, and that your payment mechanism would no longer be a credit card or a debit card. It would be the app on the smartphone that's integrated, and that this is somehow a good idea, although I've talked extensively about how easy smartphones are to completely hack and backdoor. So I consider that to be a completely brain-dead, stupid idea to go ahead and put all of your e-commerce or, you know, financial, any sort of a payment option, integrating it into a smartphone is just foolish. So one of the things that they don't bother to cover in this whatsoever is this concept of what happens when there's a problem with this one identity, or how are they possibly going to protect this one identity from getting compromised, considering that everything is going to have plugins into this enormous treasure trove of permanent identity information that you can't change. You know, your Social Security number doesn't change. You know, your email address is part of your identity now because you have that tied to so many things. Your bank account doesn't change. That number doesn't change. You know, so there's all kinds of things that, you know, this is not as simple as, oh, if there's some credit card fraud, you just go get another credit card number. Well, you can't just so easily go get a new Social Security number or a new passport, you know, or a new name, you know, new email addresses, and then migrate everything to a new email address, etc. You can't just so easily go get a new bank account. So who do you call when there's a problem with this one identity? And I think this is an extremely salient and relevant current question to ask. I've seen the havoc that something as simple as not being able to log into the Apple Store account has done to some people. I mean, they literally have an iPhone and they can't log in to their iPhone to do an update or to download an app. I mean, they're just paralyzed. They can't do anything with this device because there's an issue with the Apple account ID. And so they try to use the online system to resolve the issue with the Apple account and run into problems and roadblocks with this. And then when they call Apple to say, I need help because the system is claiming that the information I'm giving them is wrong, well, these people end up asking you questions where they're trying to verify your identity. And the thing that they are really stuck on is, what was the credit card or debit card number that was used to buy the phone when you first bought it? So that could have been 3 years ago. Regardless, most people that I know have had their phone, their credit card number changed in that time period, and they don't even have anything anymore that lists out what that credit card number plus the expiration date, because you'd have to know that too. What was that information when you purchased the phone? And what if you didn't purchase the phone? What if somebody else purchased the phone? And the way that you got this phone is, maybe one of your children got a new phone for themselves, and then they're like, hey, mom, here's a new phone. Here's my old phone. You can have it, you know? So how do you even have that information? And given how prevalent credit card number compromise is, and how frequently people have to change credit card numbers, how in the world is this a good authentication mechanism? So I've seen many people have this problem where they cannot get their Apple account issue resolved because of the fact that the system has no mechanism for a real human who's local, who actually knows you, by some other mechanism to actually take care of that account. Now, if you contrast that with another system, such as, say, business Office 365, I'm not talking about personal Office 365. If you have purchased your business Office 365 from another provider who knows you as a real human being, even if you have issues with your accounts, and this has happened occasionally, it's just no big deal. You contact those people who know you and say, hey, you know, I'm running into this problem. I can't log in. They know your voice. They know that when you send them an email, that's a legitimate email for you. You know, there's this human relationship that exists, and you're not just some sort of a number someplace or, you know, some bits in a database. And as a result, they can very quickly solve whatever problems are for you. Here's solve problems for you that you're having. And here's the other aspect too. Because they are a smaller organization, not some sort of giant behemoth, they have the capacity to respond to your requests in a timely fashion. You know, so as opposed to you're calling up Apple and saying, I can't get into my account, and you talk to one person who effectively just cannot solve your problem, and then you call back, you talk to another person who can't solve your problem. So what you're doing is you're getting people to answer the phone, but nobody can actually solve your problem. And that's because either they don't have enough brain power to do it, because they just don't understand the system, right? They're just not that technically adept. They are usually following a script. So these are, you know, glorified phone answers that have never been trained on what the back end technical stuff is. You know, or they're not empowered to make those changes. And I know for a fact that with the Apple system, they literally can't even look up your information. If you don't have this mystical credit card number that was used to purchase the phone X number of years ago, including the expiration date, I might add. If you don't have that information, then the person you're talking to on the phone is not even able to unlock, to enter into seeing your account with Apple. They don't have the authorization to do so. So how is this an effective mechanism for getting you to have access again to that account? So now imagine the situation where we have all of these services. I mean, this ubiquitousness of your life is all tied to this one identity. And this one identity is managed by who? Well, presumably Microsoft in this system. And I can tell you as a Microsoft partner that dealing with Microsoft from a support perspective is not efficient. It's extremely time consuming. It takes, in some cases, months to resolve issues. The one circumstance where their support is very effective is if you are a Microsoft partner and you are calling them for an emergency outage situation that is affecting, you know, 50 to 100 people or more, and that you are using one of your support incidences that you've paid for, I might add. Yeah, which is at a minimum $500 per incident value. Right. That's the circumstance under which you are going to get reasonably effective support. So that's not what you would characterize as a typical sort of support request. So what happens in these circumstances where you're having issues accessing things? Well, that can go on for months. It's very frustrating for us Microsoft partners in many cases trying to get various issues resolved, because Microsoft is such a behemoth and they have so many subcontractors that 90% of the time when you are interacting with somebody who's supposed to be doing support for Microsoft, you're not actually dealing with Microsoft. You're dealing with some subcontractor. And in the cases where you're calling for a massive outage fix, those subcontractors are actually quite well trained. So I don't have anything bad to say about them at all. Sometimes their English isn't very good, but they do, from a technical perspective, know what they're doing, and they're empowered to do it. And they have a very good protocol system for that. But that's the exception to the rule. In most of the other cases, I mean, it takes you a whole bunch of time to just even try it, just to get to somebody who understands what's going on, who's on the same page with you about what's going on, and then who's also empowered to fix the problem, instead of having to keep reiterating it to person after person after person after person, and all they're doing is shuffling it up the tree a little bit further, and each time you have to try to convince somebody that the problem is not you, the problem is with their system. So I can just see nothing but flaming levels of chaos coming from this one identity system. You know, and then there's nothing in their system where they're talking about a hardware-based token system. And I know with Microsoft, what they are going to be advocating is their multi-factor system, which consists of apps on a smartphone or text messages. Now, I've covered many cases before on this show, the multitudinous ways in which SMS text messaging can be hacked and stolen. So it is not to be considered a secure multi-factor authentication mechanism whatsoever. And then smartphones can be hacked. If you've got a SIM card in that smartphone, it can be hacked remotely, seamlessly, without your knowledge whatsoever, and I've seen it happen many times. And this is nothing new. This whole trend started as far back as 2009. I mean, the first smartphone hacks were going on, you know, 9 years ago. So it's nothing new. This is very, very mature, well-known, well-used, well-exposed technology, smartphone hacking. So now if your entire multi-factor authentication mechanism is residing in an app on your smartphone, and your smartphone as the underlying operating system is compromised, well then all of your multi-factor authentication is compromised. The one thing that I think has value from a multi-factor authentication perspective is really hardware-based multi-factor authentication, which is this aspect of a read-only, non-hackable token that you have physical control over, and, you know, it's a piece of hardware. It's removable from the device. It's read-only, so it can't be remotely hacked. And this is generally coming in the form of a YubiKey. Now, YubiCo is a company that's been making YubiKeys for a very long time. It's an extremely mature technology. It's very, very, very well supported and widely used. It's an exceptional tool. And the problem is that Microsoft is not advocating that. And YubiCo has a product called YubiCloud, which is they basically, if you buy a YubiKey from them, every single YubiKey already has full slot one integration into their Ubi Cloud platform. So if we were going to actually have an increase in security while still maintaining privacy, right? If the goal was actually to secure digital identities, consolidation is not how you do it. You don't substitute a digital identity that, you know, Microsoft is now the new god of keeping track of these things and you have to use their multi-factor authentication system, which doesn't include a hardware token. That's not how you do it. You don't have passwordless login to everything that all goes to heck in a handbasket if your endpoint gets compromised. Instead, what organizations should be doing, banks specifically, should simply be telling people, hey, go to YubiKey, buy a YubiKey, buy this specific device, which, by the way, is a one-time purchase of $45. And a typical YubiKey is going to last more than a decade. In fact, I've never actually seen a YubiKey die. And then all they would have to do is turn on Ubi Cloud and integration. Now, from that perspective, I can tell you that nobody's bank account's ever getting compromised again from an authentication perspective. This is not going to say that wire fraud doesn't exist in some other, you know, vector. But from an authentication perspective, even if the endpoint is compromised, the credentials cannot be stolen and then executed as a separate authentication mechanism from another separate endpoint if this hardware token authentication is involved. Now, if the endpoint is compromised and the person leaves their session with that system open, well, certainly malware can then utilize that session and do things. But note that that is not credential theft. That's a situation where there's a remote access Trojan that's been installed on that endpoint. So there's no amount of like unified identity that would do anything about that anyways. You know, it's very important that we don't get misled about what these things are supposed to solve and what their problems are. I mean, if you think about the Office of Personnel Management database compromise that included people's fingerprints, I might add. You know, these were government people, and their fingerprints were in the OPM database. And when the Chinese hacked that, you know, the entire database of government and military employees worldwide was stolen, including their fingerprints. So it was just a giant, attractive target. Look at the back-end database for HHS that was the Obamacare database. Okay, that was compromised multiple times. Why? Because it's just a giant, attractive target for somebody to go after. You know, if we've basically learned that anything can eventually get compromised, centralization is the stupidest approach ever. Look at the Equifax database. You know, centralize the identity of hundreds of millions of Americans. You know, hundreds of millions of people that had a Social Security number. Now, these may not even be citizens. They could just be a person who has a work authorization visa. So even non-citizens were affected. You know, they were getting reported into the, you know, the credit reporting database system, so their identity was compromised too. Anything that is a big, giant database of non-changeable, personally identifiable information is the sweetest target out there. So centralization of this information is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And this is exactly what Microsoft and MasterCard are advocating. And let's take this into one more element, and then we'll get into the whole creepy line video, because it's very relevant on this exact topic, is that if we look at what China is doing and has been doing for a while, they are subjugating certain people in their country by a social credit score system that says that if they engage in behavior that the communist government does not like, then their social credit score decreases. And because they have a one identity system that is fully integrated everywhere, and there is no anonymity, no privacy, nothing. There is no free will. It's you only get to do exactly what the government allows you to do. In those cases, these people can't buy a home. They can't buy a car. They can't get train tickets. They can't get plane tickets. They can't send their children to school. They may not be able to get a bank account. They can't get certain jobs. So this one identity has further implications. And there's a fascinating documentary that's been done. I really strongly recommend that you check this out. It is available as included with a Prime video subscription. So if you have Amazon Prime, then you can just go out there and find the documentary called The Creepy Line and watch it. And it talks in great depth about what Google has been doing and how Google is not doing what they say publicly that they're doing. They're instead lying and obfuscating and dancing around the edges, and they're basically being evil, which is exactly the opposite of what, you know, their premise when the organization was first started. Their motto was don't be evil. And then recently, the Google CEO Sundar Pichai lied to Congress during his testimony. He claimed that Google users could opt out of the location tracking services. But yet, the Associated Press, okay, this is not some organization that that you think is on the edge in any way. You know, I mean, let's talk about as plain old vanilla as possible is the Associated Press. So even the Associated Press does their own investigation and found out that everything that Sundar Pichai testified about with regards to opting out of the location tracking services was patently false. Pichai claimed that users had control over what information Google stored about them. And he said, for Google services, you have a choice of what information is collected. We give clear toggles by category, and you can decide to stop using it. But it's categorically untrue. Because fundamentally, if you have an Android phone, not strictly a Google phone, right? I'm talking about anything that has an Android operating system on it. And this applies to iPhones, by the way. These devices themselves and the services on them store your location data, even if you've selected a privacy setting that tells the device or the app to not do that. And the Associated Press investigated back in August, and they found that Google is actually tracking the location of its users even when the location tracking option is turned off. So, you know, I've known this for quite some time, and I've actually done the downloads of the data that they're collecting, and that's only what they actually show you. There's been many exposés that they're collecting things that they're not even showing you that they're collecting, and then how they aggregate and collect and utilize that data on the back end is pretty nefarious. So there's been quite a lot of people disturbed about this, and they are taking steps to disconnect Google from their lives. I think the scariest thing out there is there are really only two operating systems for phones that are available to the vast majority of people. Certainly, someone is able to download a completely open source flavor of Android and put that on a certain phone themselves if they want. But that does require a certain level of technical ability, which I think is outside of the reach of the most of the people out there, which is a shame. Well, I will post these links and you can check them out on your own. And please do go watch the Creepy Line documentary because it's very good.